So my first apology is that I've been given the unenviable slot before coffee, so I'll try and get this done as quickly as possible. You're probably all wondering who I am, as I'm the Sandhurst guy who's not at Sandhurst, and that's probably just as confusing for me as it is for all of you. So by way of an introduction, starting before the army and then bringing up to date, I was into miniature wargaming as a child. I then sort of stopped doing that because of the cost and the time and the effort to actually paint and then transport and then do that. I then attended KCL as a master's, did Phil's excellent course on conflict simulation. There are two ex-students here today, actually, one in DSTL, one in the field army, so you're breaking in gradually there. Not quite yet the class of 1927, but fingers crossed. then joined the army. Bear in mind that army posts are normally 2 years. I did 18 months as a rifle platoon commander. I then did a year as the Fastport Group Commander Javelin. And I learnt on the hills of Salisbury Plain that when you're trying to take out a well-dressed cavalry officer in a tank with a Javelin missile which weighs 20 kilograms all up, carrying it onto the hills, that if you don't plan and coordinate and sight correctly, you're not going to get that one opportunity to take that guy out before he can annihilate you. And that actually, a bit of wargaming there would have been a good facet, but sadly Warminster didn't wargame. I then became the IO, and David's already illustrated how hard it is to be an adversarial IO. I did my best job with my super elite team, which included a corporal who was had failed his CRB check, so he couldn't go to depot. I had another corporal who had a weight management issue, so he was in my intercell as well. And I also had a sergeant who had a hearing problem, so he couldn't be used anywhere else. So my red team was actually selected for its unsuitability to be anywhere else than its suitability to be in the incel. Less me, I'd hoped. And we were doing an exercise, and I did attempt to deploy a pillow IED in front of the blue column, which was a tactic that the Afghans were going to do. Just say this is all simulated, so nothing actually went wrong on the ground. The CO told me to not over-egg the problem, and I'll let you guess as to what actually happened when we did the exercise on that column with that pillow IED, but it's okay. My day job at the moment is I'm an adjutant in 2nd Battalion Princess of Wales's Royal Regiment, or 2PWRR for short, in Cyprus. Among my many hats that I wear, being the CO's Principal Staff Officer, the Super PA, and in charge of human resources, which is an excellent job, I recommend it to everyone. I also have the hat of being in charge of junior officer development, and that's really where I'm sort of trying to pitch this today. That's the end state I'm hoping that the army will get to. Words in bold, utilise wargaming freely. I think we've banged on about that. I do have a load of slides about why we should wargame, but I'm not going to go through them here because there are no sceptics in this room. I'll hold that for my own cohort of officers back at the unit. So, following on from what the generals said yesterday, when are we going to be doing wargaming in the army? And I'm focusing more at sort of in the field army, not at the big training events, which is what everyone else has sort of covered off. So, we talked about pegs in the sand. So, Sandhurst, they're going to do it, hopefully. And you're at Sandhurst for approximately 1 year. At the Junior Officers Tactical Awareness Course, which is a month in Warminster, then hopefully they'll do it as well. Captain's Warfare Course, which is 2 months, they'll bring it in, hopefully. And the Intermediate Command Staff College for 9 months. And then at the Advanced Command and Staff College over here. So assume all now that all these organisations will do wargaming at some point in their thing. Okay, this is the golden thread. And if the AOTCs get behind it and Sanders gets a leg up coming through. Between RMS and JOTAC, you have the Field Army. Field Army again. Field Army. You can see where I'm going with this. Okay, in the Field Army. So they're the time sets that you spend in that. So the Field Army, you'll be in for 17 years. The courses, you'll be out for approximately 3 years. So assuming that you wargame all the time on those courses, there's still a large area of gap between those where wargaming needs to be a consistent golden thread. And I would argue that that's quite a big gap for the Field Army to cover. In terms of what actually happens in those gaps, regimental duty time in a unit, in a battalion or a regiment, depending on what it is normally over here on the left. Okay, and that's where young officers come under the purview of an adjutant. After ICSE, you go into staff and other jobs, and you do come back as a company commander. So the potential there for wargaming is kind of lost. So I'm going to try and focus the attention of the brief today at the junior officer who is over here. Incidentally, most officers tend to leave the army around about that point there. If you go past ICSC, you're probably going to stay in for the long haul. So really it is about inculcating that acceptance of wargaming with the junior officers rather than bashing it into them further down the line. These are the stages of training that we go through, theoretical on the left and then physical on the right. That's where the transition happens effectively. And we use this system to introduce new methods. So we might be doing counter-IED, we might be doing conventional tank or armoured infantry tactics. Okay, and we start off theoretical and then we go physical. Okay, to put it in civilian parlance, we crawl, walk, jog, run, and then if we're really good, we get up to sprinting speed over here. So my main sort of point on that is, where do we think that wargaming can assist? Oh, sorry, I'll just point out why we do it this way. So on the left, you've got very cheap in a classroom being spoken to. On the right, $1 million exercises, live ammunition, etc. Those are the three resources that tend to go up as the training increases. Time, because there is so much stuff to do, and mandated training now in the army is beyond ridiculous, the amount of stuff you have to do to tick the box. Money, coming in the form of ammunition, the ammunition budget, booking the training areas, and also getting the transport. And then morale, because once you start doing this stuff, soldiers stop going to their own bed at night, stop having time with their family, and there is a statistical analysis of that, and you're not allowed to go over a certain number, and they come out of what's known as harmony. So we only want to do this if we absolutely have to, and we want to do it right, and we want to get good results. And that is also why we have those exercises that get tested. COs get their OJARs written about it, and there's very limited sort of appetite for failure. So that's the sort of cost increasing there between blank and live. That's where I think wargaming can help. On the left, you could obviously apply it throughout, but I think on the left is where it's going to add most value. I'm not advocating that we stop doing blank training and live training. If we could do that all the time, that would be excellent. In fact, my subalterns would rather do that than do anything else. But unfortunately, we live in a world with constraints, and those are the constraints. But I think by the time we get to the area on the right, we should be doing it as well as we can do, to the best of our ability, and not be making mistakes that we could have fixed on the left. And I'll give you some examples. So one thing that happened recently is Army 2020. The structure of the army was fundamentally changed, and at the tactical level, one of the things that happened is the rifle company had three equally sized platoons, so you could do assault, suppress, and reserve. They got rid of one of those, said the army reserve will provide that. We're still hoping that will happen one day. And the other thing they did is they took the PIDs, the bums on seats, and they changed it into a machine gun platoon of two gun lines. And a lot of OCs went, well, that's ridiculous, I can't do assault, suppress, reserve. Not actually realising that a Cold War company commander could expect to maybe get one gun line attached to him if he was on the CO's good books. He has two in organic support to his company, and I can't support assault, suppress, reserve. Well, yes, you can, sir, if you just use the guns to suppress. Then the other two can need to assault and reserve. But don't worry about that. I'm sure you're going to work that out when you get onto exercise over here and spend loads of money doing it wrong the first couple of times. So that's one example. The second example, again, Army 2020, going to light mech. The battalion is going to be doing that in 2017. Once you get into what we call the Zulu muster with the vehicles and you debus the dismounts and you leave the drivers and the commanders, the company commander has four sections or squads to move into an assault. Four. He has two platoon commanders to move four squads, which works well if he's doing the principle of four, but I don't really understand how the doctrine says we're meant to execute that. That's where a war game with some counters would probably go a long way to explain to the company commander so that he doesn't do that there, debussing, working out he has four sections. Okay. And Ivor Gardner did a bit of that in Two Will Irish, and hopefully we'll be able to glean some good stuff from that. And a micro-tactical example, the battalion did three OTXs, overseas training exercises, Jordan, Belize, and the Falkland Islands. A company commander in the Falkland Islands lost out massively on that one. In Jordan, a section commander, a corporal of about 6 years, leading his section, managed to maneuver his assaulting fire team through the path that his fire support team was firing onto the enemy position. He did it once, and then he did it again. Luckily, we were doing that, and not that. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing it twice. And that in itself is a bit of Darwinism. He was corrected, he was explained, but, you know, the exercise wasn't rerun. So he failed on that, and if we then did it live, okay, they'd have had to save stuff, and have had to stop him doing that. If he'd wargamed it, or some at some level that was appropriate to his understanding, then I think they could have identified Corporal so-and-so, you haven't got this, you've done it, you've moved that counter through that hex or whatever system you want to use, and, you know, I think you need to get a bit of refresher training. And that really is where wargaming adds value, not necessarily just as a bolt-on addition, but through the stages of training, understanding where you need to focus that refresher training and the bit where the ability spread of your guys is, rather than sort of validating an exercise at the end. Okay, some happy pie diagrams. So this is on the right, you've got a deliberate attack mission. I've taken the timings arbitrarily off my own experience. Okay, and on the left, you've got a 1 hour war game. So on a mission, which could be blank or could be live, you will find that a lot of time is taken up by doing the logistics for the actual attack, okay, 50% of the time. Okay, you're then manoeuvring to contact, and then you're actually only in contact for a small period of time. Now, that's the history of warfare. I'm not suggesting we change that and we go straight to more combat. I'm simply saying that actually when you go and do a week of exercise, you're only doing a day of combat if you condense it all together. On a war game, however, because we abstract the manoeuvring and the logistics and the planning, you do a lot more combat for the time that you spend on the war game. So if we could want to focus that, because that's actually where the adversarial nature of war is going to be. It is important that we practice how to get out the door with the kit and all the rest of it. I'm not suggesting we get rid of that. That's why officers learn to map read. But if we can take that and apply it to that, then we will get better results when we do go out the door and do that, rather than potentially wasting our time. Okay, so focusing on the junior officers then, quick run through of some good points that I think we should be using for war games. Go back to my notes. So, command. It's a fundamental part of being an officer. The three areas you get assessed on: command, leadership, and management. You do some of that in barracks. The command bit is what you exercise on the troops. We need to get like-for-like representation between what they command in the field, in the war game, and also have the advantage that we can actually bring in assets that they don't have in the real world because they're on other training cycles, etc., and we can put them into a war game. It must demand them to think and make decisions, and this is all stuff that's been said before, and put them preferably under time pressure, resulting in cognitive stress. One of the things the Army was looking at is whether we could go to four sections in a platoon rather than three. One of the things they identified is the platoon commander had a lot of cognitive stress, having that fourth manoeuvre element. Okay, so they need to be under that, because that's the reality. Firepower. The correct modelling of this is essential. DSDL and OA have a part to form the base of this. It's a fundamental part of the tactical action, fire and manoeuvre. So we need the operational analysis and the historical analysis to tell us how effective our firepower is in two areas. The physical, what the round does to the other target, and two, the psychological, which is what we don't really do very much at. As General Sharp said, when you shoot somebody, they're influenced. When you drop a 105 shell on them, they're even more influenced. If you don't factor that in, then you know, you're just going off the hit ratios, and unfortunately a lot of our kit doesn't actually produce the kill ratios we would believe it to. And if you're looking for kill ratios, you're going down that attritional route, and that's just the path to frontal attacks, and we don't need to go through that again. It must encourage the effective positioning and coordination of firepower within the wargame dynamics. Okay, manoeuvre. It's the partner's firepower, because fire without movement is indecisive, but movement without fire is disastrous. Mastery of the terrain is a vital component of effective manoeuvre. So we need topography, we need line of sight, we need going, no-go, slow-go, and good-go. And that will encourage risk. Cover and concealment, because as an infantryman, you do fight on the ground. But it applies, everyone's already said it about the tank that fires 4K, but if you're in woods, it can't, so use the woods. And the application of shock force, close quarters assault, with its physical, but more importantly, its psychological effects. That's why the infantry use the bayonet, which hasn't killed anyone in a long time, although a Gurkha has killed somebody with a GPMG tripod. We put the bayonet on because it shows an intent to close with and kill the enemy, and it has a psychological effect, and we do a lot of training to buoy up our own psychology to do that. We wouldn't do that for the physical effects. The physical effects are nothing because the enemy isn't there when you get there. And the aim should be to reward the player, bringing strength against the adversary's weakness, such as his flanks or his rear. And they need to be thinking, our junior officers need to be thinking, how do I make this an unfair fight for my enemy? Not, how do I do this, you know, the way the template says. And logistics, because amateurs study the tactics and professionals study logistics, which is what late entry officers love to tell me all the time. We live in a world of finite resources, and those are only getting more and more finite. With conflicting priorities, you need to forward plan, you need to make hard choices about where you're going to spend those resources. At the junior officer level, I think mostly it's ammunition and medical. Ammunition was what will stop you having a combat effect, and the medical will reduce your combat power because you will need to suck some resources to deal with your casualties. And time, obviously, is the quantity that the officer will never have enough of, okay, nor should he be given too much because he's not going to get it in real life. Morale, because more battles are lost through the loss of heart than the loss of blood. History teaches us that less than 30% destruction is required to win. I have never fought an enemy in the British Army who went away after 30% destruction. I have myself been destroyed down to 30%, but I have never met an enemy that has run away after 30% destruction. So we have always done a bit of worst case exercising. Morale is a combat multiplier. Having high morale leads to good results. That's why we invest a lot of effort into welfare and looking after our soldiers. And leaders should, where possible, sustain their own while seeking to attack the enemy's morale. That's the manoeuvrist approach. We talk about it a lot. We don't do it as much as we say. And that low-level leadership is key. That's why a lot of war games have leader counters. And when leaders get killed or wounded, you often see sometimes you see a negative correlation, sometimes you see a positive correlation, depending on what leadership you've got at the time. And then the friction and uncertainty, and that's why the dice are up there. Because everything in war is simple, but the simplest things are difficult. Military operations are always beset by uncertainty and chance. The DAF will break down, it will roll over, someone will take the wrong turning, etc., etc. And that's why we need to have people who see the plan as nothing, but planning as everything, and that's been mentioned as well. And we need to avoid training officers practice strict, dogmatic execution of an obsolete plan. We must never substitute planning for hasty intuition if time allows for it. Because what we want to avoid are a generation of cuffers who just stand up there and say, well, it's all going to change when I hit contact, so I'll just cuff it. Well, no, you need to think about how you're going to react using the factors, and then don't stick rigidly to your plan. Using those things I said there, that's the game I ran yesterday, and you can see that there's some areas for improvement. And this is my final slide. So, just the last points at the top. Blue generally wins, but Blue came to the fight with the balance of forces. He came to win an unfair fight. So well done, Blue. The lesson there is don't go to a fair fight. The importance of sequencing activity. Just because you can move a counter, people did, but sometimes that meant you revealed yourself to enemy fire. And that's a good, important lesson for platoon commanders as well. And there was a sort of think to the finish factor. What do I do after the first assault? When the Red Force over here then actually engaged you. Okay, and not many people have thought that. And that is a classic shoot problem. When I did that shoot, I didn't think about that 5 years ago. And Red worked out when to quit, which was great because it showed that everyone understood the war game dynamics. And actually, why would Red stay and fight if it's not going to win? Which is what Red would do in reality. Unless maybe the Chinese, and it would just keep pushing forward. Oh, and that's some wider utility, which I think is important, but I won't stress it because it's already been mentioned. And that's me. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We heard four quite different presentations there. But what I'm just going to do is draw a few similarities out of it, and then we'll go to questions. We've got time for a few questions. So what we heard about best practice, it depends. Great MOD answer. It depends. It depends on what it is you're trying to achieve with your war game. But there are some threads that we can draw through. There are some questions that we can help ourselves use to help ourselves in the design and delivery of a war game. What are we trying to achieve? Is it worthy of a war game? If it's worthy of a war game, what are the objectives and aims of the war game, and therefore, what are the mechanics we should use? What level of representation is necessary? What roles do we need? What level of participation? Who is doing what? What are the mechanics? How do I best immerse people in the war game? How do I make it credible? How do I make it believable? How do I make it fun and good to play? How do I capture and analyse the outputs? And if you think about all those things before you deliver your war game, you might be in a good place. And when you've thought about all those things, then you need to plan, prepare your players if necessary. Think creatively. Make sure you control and facilitate your outcomes. And remember the constraints in which you're operating. And then, to make it really worthwhile, you've got to actually use it and do it. And I think we're getting there in the MOD. So, questions.